This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Let's get underway with prayer this morning. Our Heavenly Father, we come to you with grateful hearts for your bountiful provision, the way in which you take care of us. We thank you for giving us rest. We thank you for giving us all that we need for our physical bodies. But above all, we thank you that we can rest in you through the work of our Savior, Jesus Christ. It's in his name that we come to you and ask that you would help us today to have alert minds, to have faithful minds. We ask that you would provide for our every need, not just those things which sustain us in this world, but that you would help us to think clearly and provide for our needs in the life that is to come as well. We do pray that you would help us to think faithfully, that we would be true to our Savior, Jesus Christ. We do ask that you would enable us to speak boldly, courageously, and truthfully for the sake of the Christian faith in a day that so often disdains the truth that you have given us. Lord, we do thank you that you have blessed us by your grace, that you have given us the gift of faith and enlightened our minds, that we would not wander in the confusion and experience the kinds of consequences of rebellion that the world undergoes. Do give us today, through our considerations, a greater appreciation for the grace that is ours, through Christ our Savior, in whose name we pray. Amen. Today in our considerations, we're going to be looking at perhaps the two most influential thinkers of the 19th century in terms of the cultural effects that we have lived through in the 20th century. I don't think that they're the most intelligent men of the 19th century, indeed far from it. When we get done with today's lecture, I hope I will have convinced you that they were both very bad in terms of their scholarship. But nevertheless, it must be acknowledged that their effect on the way in which people look at things in this world and the way we've experienced life in the 20th century really cannot be estimated highly enough. We're going to be looking at the work of Charles Darwin and other evolutionists, and then also the work of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. We come to Darwin along the route of 19th century secularism. As you recall, I have tried to organize 19th century thought for you as three kinds of response to the skepticism of Hume and the anti-metaphysical agnosticism of Kant. And I said one primary way in which philosophers responded was the rationalistic route of Hegel, absolute idealism. And then we looked at a number of non-cognitive ways in which people responded to Kant by Schopenhauer's voluntarism, or through Romanticism, Kierkegaard's subjective individualism, and then finally Nietzsche's nihilism. And thirdly, we began a consideration of the secular, more materialistic, empiricistic responses to Hume and Kant. And we've looked already at utilitarianism and materialism, positivism, and we're on evolutionary naturalism as we continue our lecture today. I suppose if Charles Darwin had not written the theory of evolution, somebody would have had to anyway. It was virtually inevitable if you stop and think about trends in the history of philosophy. If you believe that all of reality is material in nature, and that there's a history to everything, there's a kind of a development, then if man is part of nature, you add that to the mix, then obviously man must have some kind of materialistic developmental background. All the pieces for the evolutionary view of man were in place long before Charles Darwin was born. Now I'm going to come back to this as a major criticism of the theory a little bit later. But I want you to be aware of that fact that evolutionary naturalism is a is something which is philosophical in character and virtually inevitable from a cultural standpoint. Nevertheless, we look at Charles Darwin as the leading representative, obviously, of the evolutionary outlook. Darwin's dates are 1809 to 1882. His grandfather was Erasmus Darwin, who already had certain proto-evolutionary ideas. His father was a wealthy medical doctor. And in 1831, he graduated from Cambridge University. At that point, he spent 5 years on the HMS Beagle, returning to England in 1838, having become a very zealous student of natural history. It's because of the data that he collected on the Beagle during this five-year journey that he was led, he said, to his evolutionary hypothesis. In 1859, Darwin published his book, The Origin of Species. That's actually not the full title, a nice long title. You should be aware, however, that a year before he published this, he had received from Alfred Wallace an essay that already used the terminology of survival of the fittest, natural selection. So there is some question in terms of scholarly credentials, how much Darwin should get credit for and how much Wallace should be given credit. But historically, it's Darwin that we remember. He hurried into print so that he could present his thesis. This book, The Origin of Species, was in fact a turning point in Western culture. Although all the gestation of these ideas had been in process for quite a long time, it was Darwin who gave birth finally to this idea that man is a natural product and we do not need to go to any kind of supernatural explanation to account for the development, not just of man, but of all other natural species. So this is a turning point culturally and philosophically, and to let you know how much it already reflected the spirit of its day, the first printing of The Origin of Species sold out on the first day that it was available. The entire printing was gone in one day. If ever there was a theory the world was aping, you know, to have, just grasping to have, it was evolution. Darwin should also be remembered for his book, The Descent of Man, published in 1871. I'd like to indicate two things that I believe are, above all, the significance of his evolutionary hypothesis. The first is this. Darwin was attempting to show that even in biology, explanations should be non-teleological. Even in biology, explanations should be non-teleological. In our last class period, we looked at the views of Ernst Haeckel. Haeckel was a physicist, if you will, who believed that everything in this world operates according to iron laws. He saw the universe in a machine-like way. What usually stands against that view of the universe, totally apart from religious considerations, is the field of biology. Because in biology, it would appear that things do not happen or develop in the way that machines do. Just with previous or antecedent causal factors determining the outcome. Many people have thought, well, life, bios, biology, has a kind of inner dynamic, a vital principle that is oriented toward development or growth or some kind of goal that cannot necessarily be predicted from antecedent causes. If you were to look at a tadpole, you would not predict a frog. There's an inner principle of biological development. And so up until the days of Darwin, biology was thought of as a teleological science rather than a mechanical science. Those are the two poles you want to have in your mind. Mechanical explanation over against teleological. Teleological comes from the Greek word telos, meaning aim or purpose. So an explanation that is teleological looks ahead to what is being developed, what the outcome or consequences are going to be, whereas a mechanical looks only to antecedent causes. Darwin's significance is that he argued that even in biology, we don't need teleological explanation. That the question of origins is really a neutral and non-theological question. A neutral, non-theological question. Indeed, part of Darwin's frustration as a man living in English culture is that he couldn't see why anybody thought this was somehow an attack on theology. Because Darwin didn't view himself as trying to, you know, put God out of the picture. He was just trying to say that the way things happen in the biological sphere doesn't require God's intervention. You don't need, for the origin of species, for the development of different life forms, you don't need to bring God into the picture. And so his first major significance was to turn biology into a non-teleological, allegedly neutral, and non-theological domain. Secondly, in terms of the key significance of Darwin's hypothesis, he put what appeared to be the stamp of scientific approval and credentials on the notion of developmental process, that reality is characterized by developmental process. Even man can be explained in terms of the process of his historical development, his origin, which is biological, but not teleological or theological. So you put all that together, and that really is the underlying philosophical and, I think, cultural significance of Darwin. But, of course, from the scientific side, or the allegedly scientifically side, what Darwin offered to the world was a thesis that could explain the origin of species. And very simply, he argued for what he called natural selection by means of survival of the fittest. Natural selection by means of survival of the fittest. Elementary life forms develop through gradual changes. Gradualism was necessary, according to Darwin's hypothesis. He didn't want to resort to what is called saltation, the appearance of freaks of nature, or if you will, radical jumps, mutations that push along the development and alteration of life forms. He wanted to see everything explained in terms of gradual changes, and every change takes place and is preserved in a race or a biological form because it is advantageous for the survival of that life form. So what happens is nature selects the development of certain life forms that we come to call horses and giraffes and bears and human beings and so forth. Nature selects these things in the same way that a breeder selects for favored characteristics, whether you're looking at pigeons or roses or whatever it may be. Nature selects those biological forms that will survive. They're all changing, but the ones that survive are those that are most fit for survival. So you have gradualism taking place throughout the natural world, gradual changes, and those changes which are beneficial for survival make the form that is changing in that particular way the fittest to survive. It's been selected by nature to survive. There are other evolutionists of the 19th century whose names you should at least be familiar with and a little bit about their contribution. Charles Darwin, of course, is the leading light in terms of the evolutionary hypothesis. Herbert Spencer should be remembered as well, 1820 to 1903. Herbert Spencer, an Englishman who had a kind of cosmic, mystical understanding of evolution. Where Darwin was paying attention to the origin of species within the animal realm, Spencer is the one who said, actually, this is a principle that explains all of the cosmos. And so evolution became for him not just a scientific theory. Of course, it never was merely a scientific theory. But, I mean, he went way beyond what everybody understood evolution to be in terms of a limited hypothesis about the natural world and turned it into a cosmic principle. Samuel Alexander, 1859 to 1938, kind of foreboding, isn't it, that he was born in the same year that The Origin of Species was published. 1859, he lived to 1938. Samuel Alexander applied the notion of evolution and gradualism to the emergence of the mind of man from the brain tissue of man. Okay, so Alexander is known as an emergent evolutionist, E-M-E-R-G-E-N-T, emergent evolutionist, because he believed that eventually the physical stuff of man, the brain tissue, gives rise to, or what emerges from it, is the mind of man, mind being more than brain. I just want to remind you of that, though in popular terminology or in common parlance, you will maybe use brain and mind interchangeably. They are quite different philosophical concepts. The brain has to do with the gray matter that you can, you know, cut open the cranium and pour out, whereas the mind is something which is not looked upon as a physical thing. What the relationship between the mind of man and the brain of man is, of course, a big philosophical question. It was Samuel Alexander's view that our mind, our abilities to reason, to make moral decisions, emerge eventually from the development of the brain tissue itself, an emergent evolutionist. And then another evolutionist that you should identify in the 19th century, T.H. Huxley. Huxley's dates are 1825 to 1895. Huxley was so enthusiastic for the Darwinian hypothesis and became such a popularizer of it that he earned the name Darwin's Bulldog. Darwin's Bulldog. Here was the one who would defend and promote the outlook of Charles Darwin. Huxley is also known, I think more importantly, for being a philosopher who attempted to deal with the conflict that exists between the evolutionary process and the ethical process. That is, Huxley recognized that evolution in itself may make ethics impossible. After all, if everything's accounted for in terms of biological gradual development, where then does man's ethical nature come from? Now, Samuel Alexander has addressed one problem. Where does man's mental or rational ability come from? He was an emergent evolutionist. Huxley deals with where does man's ethical nature come from? After all, if men live just as animals do in nature, then men should live as animals do, red in tooth and claw, right? Blood red. That is, we should just act like animals toward one another. We should be uncivilized. Now, how can a Victorian scholar from a well-bred family, as the Huxley family was, how can he account for the civilized character of man if he's nothing but an animal? And it was Huxley who had addressed to him the sarcastic question whether he had evolved from apes on his mother or his father's side. You know, in terms of, you want to look at genealogy, I mean, which was just the way of needling the hypothesis. He had an equally sharp comeback to the person who asked him that question, but Huxley had to address this. Now, how does man have a civilized character? Where does the ethical process of thinking in man come from if he's nothing but a product of biological evolution? And it was his view that man evolves to a point where he's more than a pawn of nature, that when man's mind evolves sufficiently, man can now start interacting with the process of change. That is, he can take his destiny in his own hands and start directing, or at least curbing, interacting in a cybernetic way with the biological changes that are taking place as well. That is, man starts controlling his environment, controlling, therefore, his own personal development. And that then opens the door to man being ethical, making decisions which are not simply a reflection of his natural character. I'll let the reader decide for himself. I'll let you students decide for yourselves whether Samuel Alexander or T.H. Huxley are very persuasive. I find these a fool's errand intellectually, you know, running around like fools to do something to take care of a theory that has gaping holes in it. I don't think that emergent evolution accounts for man's rational abilities, and I don't believe the idea that man's mind develops to a point where he can make decisions about his environment really accounts for his moral character or the reasoning process in ethics. But you should be aware of these. So cosmic evolution, kind of a mystical approach to evolution with Herbert Spencer. The mind is accounted for by Samuel Alexander and man's moral abilities and character by T.H. Huxley. Do you have any questions about the theory of evolution as a theory? I don't need people to help me criticize it yet. I haven't gotten to that part of the lecture. Yes.
The point Darwin coming about, is that where people started to have hypotheses about the old Earth? Or was that, as people thought about the Earth being older than the
Earth? No, the question of uniformitarian geology had arisen prior to Darwin, and that then raises the question of the age of the Earth. So no, that isn't... Darwin, in a sense, helps settle a particular view on that, but he did not, it wasn't with him that issue originated. Yes, Will? Yeah, the Huxley family is very fertile in terms of cultural thought, and yes, eugenics was something that was toyed with. We finally get to Aldous Huxley in the 20th century as the man who proposed drugs as a mind-altering who proposed that we use drugs for the sake of altering our minds and having a better consciousness about what the real world is. I'll let you do some research on that. I'm not sure. All right, I have six criticisms I'd like to make of Darwinian evolution. And the first criticism, and the one that I think is the most important for you philosophically and culturally, the first criticism is, the theory of evolution is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a scientific theory. It is a philosophical theory. Now, I know how politically incorrect what I'm saying is. And it's not out of, you know, like a desperation that I want to save for philosophy something important to talk about. But it's just a matter of fact that this is not a scientific theory. Yes, it has the cosmetic appearance of being scientific, because Darwin offered, you know, examples from the natural world. Hypothetical examples, by the way, not ones that he could actually prove. But nevertheless, since it's applied to the natural world and it's scientists who are proposing it, people have it in their minds. They just take it for granted. I don't think they propose the question, is evolution scientific? They consider the possibilities and say, yes, I think it's scientific. It's not even a question. It's just taken for granted. It's a non-negotiable kind of spirit of the age that has been adopted by people, as Francis Schaeffer says, in the way that people catch the measles. You don't think about getting the measles and go out looking for it. You just get infected. People grow up infected with the idea that evolution is a scientific theory rather than a matter of philosophy. It, in fact, is not. You've already been given the initial indications of this in my telling you that if Darwin had not written this, someone would have had to have done so. The 19th century was pregnant with this idea. And it just took somebody to break the waters, you know, and let the baby out, frankly. Because man had been made part of nature. Nature was seen in a developmental way. Everything is material. We don't need the intervention of God to account for things. I mean, it doesn't take long, and eventually, again, there the baby is going to be. Well, then man must have evolved from nature developmentally as well. This whole idea was in the air philosophically. Remember Hegel. Remember any number of previous philosophers. In fact, you can go all the way back to the ancient world. Anaximander, the second of the Ionian philosophers, had an evolutionary philosophy of where man came from. And so the theory of evolution, one, is not new, and secondly, was certainly not developed by Charles Darwin. The only thing Darwin did is give a cosmetic of scientific respectability to a philosophical view that had been posited off and on for years and was in, as I said, in the process of developing in the 19th century anyway. Another indication, I've given you what we'll call the genetic indication that Darwinism was not scientific but philosophical, that is looking at its genesis. You all should be chuckling that since Darwinism is supposed to be a genetic account of something, well then let's give a genetic account of Darwinism. We'll return the favor here. But more than the genetic indication that these views were already in the air philosophically and had been proposed previously, we have also, the, if you will, the way the theory was treated. Let me give you an example. T.H. Huxley once said that the reason the world jumped at Darwin is because, to use his own personal example, he'd been studying the natural world, and every time he would look for an explanation and pursue it, he would finally come up against a barrier that had on it, "You can go no further by order of Moses." Okay, this is a sarcastic way of saying, well, we get to a certain place and then we just have to accept theological explanations. And according to Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, what Darwin did is that he broke down that barrier so that no longer is it something to be untrammeled to look into the very origin of man himself. And he says that's what made this theory so important. It gave us a way around Moses. That's a fascinating insight. Here in the name of allegedly objective science, pursuing the facts wherever they lead us, you have somebody saying, I endorse this, and the rest of us in our society, in our culture that follow this, are endorsing this because it provides us a way around theology. Well, but of course, motivation is not supposed to affect scientific theory. I mean, it's not supposed to. It's unavoidable, really. But when people think it was just somehow the neutral, observational study of the natural world that led Darwin to the theory of evolution, they are naive. They are children intellectually. I mean, that is, you might as well believe in Santa Claus if you believe in that. And by their own admission. Thirdly, you need to realize that the theory of evolution has been defended from the get-go, and especially in our own generation, not by a willingness to engage in objective public debate, but has been defended through political narrowing and persecution. We've had nothing less in the 20th century than a complete reversal of the Scopes trial. As you know, in Tennessee in the 1920s, a man by the name of Scopes, wanted to bring in the evolutionary hypothesis into the teaching of science. There the argument was students should at least be allowed to hear both sides or alternative views. And now, in the 20th century, the late 20th century, we've had a number of court cases where the equal treatment of creationism and evolution have been set forth, certain states wanting to require the public schools to present both. And the courts have said, no, only evolution can be presented as scientific because creationism is not scientific. And so, I mean, talk about a metamorphosis. Back Scopes wants, if you will, the ability to have both points of view set forward. And now at the end of the century, we have the courts defending the presentation of only one point of view. Now, why is it that only one point of view is being presented? After all, the truth is nothing to fear from open exposure, right? That's what we're told by humanists all the time. In London, Museum of Natural History was going to present a display on evolution, on Darwinism, and the display was going to concede, well, not so much concede, but acknowledge at a certain point, that there are difficulties in the theory. And there was such a hue and cry, an outrage, that the museum was forced to take out any indication of, well, here's a problem that still needs to be worked out in the theory. Now, why is that? Why is it that we can't even, in a museum display, point out a difficulty in the theory? So the theory of evolution is being advanced today not on its scientific credentials. It is, in fact, a metaphysical hypothesis. The leading evolutionist, at least culturally best known evolutionist in America today, is Stephen Jay Gould, paleontologist at Harvard. G-O-U-L-D. Stephen Jay Gould. Gould has recently set forth a theory known as punctuated equilibria, which is an intellectual farce in itself, punctuated equilibria. Well, let me tell you about that real quickly, and then I'll come back to my main point, that what Gould says about the status of the theory of evolution. If you look at the fossil record, one of the things that has embarrassed evolutionists from the very outset, in fact, it was one of the earliest refutations of Darwin. If you look at the fossil record, there's no evidence of gradual development from one species to another. To use the layman's language, there are no missing links. And yet, given the theory, there should be almost innumerable cases of transient and intervening forms from one to another. And yet there are none. Well, that's an embarrassment if you're an evolutionist. And so Gould has proposed the theory that evolution takes place in spurts rather than over long periods of gradual development. So that you'll have a period of evolutionary change that's hot and fast, you know, and then it cools and it plateaus. And then you'll have another period. And so what you have is a punctuated evolutionary change with periods of equilibrium between, so punctuated equilibria. I would be happy if some of you would get hold of the tapes that I have done on the theory of evolution from our study center, from the tape ministry, and you'll do some more advanced study. In my public discussion of these matters, I explained to my students that punctuated equilibria amounts to the theory that evolution, the evidence for evolution is that there can be no evidence for it. Because you see, given Stephen Jay Gould's view of the matter, there never could be fossil evidence for evolution. So when we go to the fossil record and we don't find any evidence of evolution, aha, the absence of evidence becomes a positive indication for our theory. This is a child's game, punctuated equilibria. What it is reasoning by embarrassment. since the facts don't support my theory, what I'll do is I'll redevelop the theory so I can hold on to my conclusion and work my way around the facts. Which is interesting because with Huxley, we learned that evolution was an attempt to work its way around theology, around Moses and divine intervention. And by the time we get to Stephen Jay Gould, evolution is an attempt to work our way around the facts. See, this is not a scientific theory. This is a philosophical commitment. And so going back to the article where Stephen Jay Gould proposes punctuated equilibria, he says explicitly the theory of evolution is not a high-level generalization from the study of nature. It is a metaphysical commitment that we have made. Now, because you're going to go out into a world where people are just, well, they don't think, obviously. They're not self-reflective. They haven't been exposed to things. They just buy every child's story that comes down the pike. You're going to run into people who think evolution is a scientific theory. But the leading scientist, at least in our culture today, the leading proponent of evolution today, concedes explicitly in print it is not a high-level scientific generalization. He said it's a metaphysical commitment. It's a view of reality that we have adopted. And he believes the progress of science has justified that view of reality, but it is not something that comes from our exploration of the facts. And so I've given you three lines of evidence. First of all, that evolution is not a scientific theory. It is a philosophical theory. Any questions about this so far? Secondly, you need to know about Darwinian evolution, that the thesis was refuted immediately, within months of its appearance. Leading scholars had ravaged the theory of evolution for its being anti-scientific, not according with the facts, not according with paleontology, the fossil record, and as a matter of fact, being promoted on the basis of hypothetical projections. So Darwin's thesis was never scientific. The cosmetic was scientific, but it was really just covering an underlying philosophy. Secondly, the thesis was immediately refuted. Why then did it become popular? Why did it sell out on the first day? Well, as I've already indicated, because of its anti-religious motivation. Darwinism has captured our culture not because of its academic credentials, but because of its anti-religious motivation. Thirdly, from a philosophical standpoint, the theory of evolution is not even a scientific hypothesis subject to testing. It is only an ideological tautology. I'll let you write that down, then I'll explain what I'm saying. The theory of evolution is not a scientific hypothesis subject to testing. It is an ideological tautology. What did I tell you back when I introduced this? What did I tell you was Darwin's contribution? It was the thesis of survival of the fittest, right? Natural selection by means of survival of the fittest. And what I'm saying is survival of the fittest is an ideological tautology. It is not a thesis subject to scientific examination and refutation. Do you know what a tautology is? A logical equation? Right? When I say that all bachelors are unmarried men, am I giving you any information that's subject to testing out in the world, or am I giving you a tautology? Bachelor is defined as an unmarried man, so of course all bachelors are unmarried men. When I say the red barn is red, I have not added anything to the information you have about the subject of that sentence by what I said in the predicate of the sentence. The red barn is red is a sentence where the subject is red barn, the predicate is red. So, have I added anything to your knowledge of the subject when I give you the sentence? No. That's a tautology. Likewise, by the way, when somebody proposes something that's supposed to be some grand factual explanation and it resolves into a tautology, that's a major embarrassment. That's when you, you know, kind of like fold up the tent and go home and don't show your face in public anymore. Charles Darwin's theory of survival of the fittest is a grand ideological tautology. It is not a scientific thesis subject to testing at all. And why is that? Because in order to test the thesis, you would have to be able to identify the fittest biological forms or animal forms and then look to see whether they in fact survived. So there must be separate identification of the two classes of things, the fittest things and the surviving things. Now, if you can separately identify them, then you can test what their relationship is. Darwin's theory was the relationship is one of identity. The fittest are identical with the survivors, right? But it's only a scientific thesis if you can first identify the two classes without reference to one another. If I were to set forth this scientific, allegedly scientific hypothesis, that the best chefs in the world are all NBA basketball players, the only way in which you could test that hypothesis scientifically is if you could first identify NBA basketball players without reference to their culinary skills and identify the best chefs in the world. And now I set forth this thesis. This is rather radical, you know. I come forth and you can see all the cultural magazines covering, Dr. Bonson proposes amazing hypothesis that the best chefs in the world are all NBA basketball players. Somebody says, hey, I've got a counterexample. They bring some guy from France who doesn't even know how to dribble a basketball. They say, here's one of the best chefs in the world, and he's not an NBA basketball player. I say, if he's not an NBA basketball player, he's not one of the best chefs in the world. Now, if we were to do this sort of thing, all of you, and not just you, our whole culture, would laugh me off the platform and say, well, what a fool. That's not a scientific hypothesis. Now, why aren't we laughing about the survival of the fittest, then? It's because we have, as part of the spirit of our age, come to reverence this theory as something scientific. It's an absolute absurdity to see that as a scientific hypothesis. You know why? Because when you identify the fittest members of a certain species, the reason they're considered the fittest is because you know that they have survived. Indeed, this is what usually happens when biologists look at the animal world and try to identify the fittest members. A good example that you find in the literature is that of a particular kind of wolf, that when you compare that wolf with its brothers and sister wolves, different kinds of wolves, it has a stronger pair of hind quarters, okay? The muscles in its back legs are stronger than the others, more fully developed. And so now you start reasoning, well, now a wolf that has stronger hindquarters will be faster. The faster wolves, these are all generalizations, particular exceptions are quite acceptable, but in general, a wolf that is got stronger back legs is going to be a faster wolf. A faster wolf is going to get to the kill more often first than the others, and therefore it will have a tendency to survive rather than the wolves that don't get enough to eat and die out in the winter. So the thesis, I'm being real general here, the thesis is, here you have the fittest, and now we're going to go out and see whether it survives, right? Well, what you have to test, though, is the survival of the entire wolf, not just the survival of its fit back legs. Isn't that right? What if it turns out that because this wolf has such a developed pair of hindquarters, that there's a strain put on its heart, and therefore wolves that have this mutation tend not to get to the kill first because they tend to die of heart attacks? Now, what if that were to happen? I mean, I don't know. But, you know, if we were to find that were to happen, we'd say, oh, well, the stronger hindquarters were not an advantage for survival. They were a disadvantage because of the strain. All right, so survival of the fittest suffers from a similar defect in that it proves not to be a testable hypothesis at all, because it's just an outlook that says, well, the survivors must have been the fittest ones. Oh, and how do you know that? Well, because they survived. So the circle's complete. It's nothing but an ideological tautology. It's a vision of the world. All right? It's a certain conception of how the world works. But it's not a conception that's been built up from factual analysis, and it's not a conception that can be tested by empirical facts. And this is the philosophical refutation of evolution as a scientific view. I started out by giving you three indications from the nature of the thesis and how it's presented and its historical context, that it was not scientific but philosophical. Secondly, I've said that it was refuted immediately and yet held on to, apparently for its anti-religious benefits. And then thirdly, I've pointed out that the central thesis, the driving engine of evolution that Darwin proposed, is in fact not a scientific view at all, but it's a philosophical view. It's a concept that's imposed on the facts, not taken from the facts. Fourthly, there are numerous scientific flaws in the theory of evolution. Numerous scientific flaws. And because most people don't realize that, I'm only going to talk about five of them. But trust me, if you gave me 2 or 3 days, I could fill the days with lectures on just the scientific defects of evolution. Other people can do it much better than me. I'm a philosopher. But there are books on the subject that deal with the problems, contemporary books on the subject that deal with the problems, the evolutionary thesis. So let me just give you a few illustrations. First, the theory of evolution is workable only if the evolutionist affirms spontaneous generation or prebiotic evolution. That is, life has to come from somewhere. So either it's spontaneously generated, which was a view that was held earlier, or since the 1950s, there have been people who have proposed what's called prebiotic evolution. Prebiotic, before life. There was an evolution, a stage of chemical evolution, where things finally came together and formed cells that were alive. And of course, that requires that first the building blocks of life would be chemically united, so forth. So you either have spontaneous generation, which of course is a completely discredited theory, or more lately, prebiotic evolution. And the thing that has given the headaches to prebiotic evolution is our increasing knowledge of DNA. If you have any study of DNA and the complexity of DNA, and also what conditions are necessary for the development of those acids and other molecules that becomes the DNA molecule, you realize that, as one book put it, it is not just unlikely, but it's virtually impossible that any kind of bringing together of chemicals incidentally would allow for the complexity of the DNA molecule. So here's the first major problem of evolution, is that it cannot account for life. Secondly, evolution by means of gradual change, well, evolution must be driven by either gradual changes or by huge mutations. And both of those hypotheses, just like the first set of hypotheses, have their difficulties. First of all, the problems in the notion of gradual changes. Darwin himself said that if there could be shown any life form that could not be accounted for, its origin could not be accounted for by gradual change, he said he would have to abandon his thesis. Well, there are so many we could offer that it's, you know, child's play. Let's ask ourselves about the theoretical possibility of the gradual development of heart-lung biological forms. That is, those animals that have hearts and lungs. Of course, you have to have them both, don't you? Heart without a lung doesn't do you any good. Lung without a heart doesn't do you any good. And let's add to this mix now the supreme difficulty that a gradual heart An unfully developed heart doesn't do you any good, and an unfully developed lung doesn't do you any good. And so just stop and think of it. It's child's play, intellectually. I realize intellectuals have their motivations, and so they won't acknowledge the problems, but, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to say, no, wait a minute. I first of all don't see how you could have a heart develop gradually, stage by stage by stage, because every development is supposed to be beneficial for survival, but a partially developed heart is not beneficial for survival. Nor is a partially developed lung. And now we want to add to, now we can multiply almost to infinity the difficulty in that even if you could get a heart gradually and get a lung gradually, it'd do you no good unless you got them both working together. It has to be simultaneous, which just factors the complexity and difficulty, like I say, almost to infinity. Gradual changes. How do you account for the feather of a bird? Well, the reigning hypothesis is birds evolved from reptiles. Reptiles have scaly skin. The scaly skin developed in a sagging way, and that turned into the feather of the bird. You see, because if you get a lot of skin, you know, developing down the side of your body here, then when you put your arm out, it's a little reptile arm, put your arm out like this, then you get a little bit of a wing here. So like if you're up on the top of a rock, then as a reptile, you can go off the rock and you can glide. Yeah, go ahead and laugh. There are people in secular universities that presented to them. They think that's a real serious hypothesis. Well, of course, there's a great difficulty in that the feather of a bird will not be beneficial for flight, will not give lift if it's not firm, all right? You can't have a real flaccid wing and be able to get off the ground. It won't work. On the other hand, you can't get from the reptile skin to the firmness of the feather in one generation. And so by gradual development, how would we ever get bird wings? I mean, the theory of evolution just cannot account for it, but I can give you an even a worse one. I trust all of you have done some study of the natural world. You're not complete ivory tower philosophers like some people I know. You know something about the lungs of a bird? Birds have a unique kind of lung, unlike every other kind of animal. Or every other vertebrate, anyway. You know what I'm referring to? Think about human lungs, the way they work. Air is taken in, okay, to my lungs, and the air goes down all the bronchial passages until it finally gets out to the end. And what happens is it makes a U-turn in that tube and comes back out. So that in the tubes of a human lung, air is going two ways at once. You have the air that's coming in passing the air that's going out. All right? It's really, that in itself is amazing to me, what God has done in the lung. But birds don't have that kind of lung. Birds have what I can call, in a layman's language, one-way lungs. They don't have air come in and then turn around at the bottom of the brachial tree and come back out. They have a different kind of distribution of oxygenation of their bodies where the air comes in and passes straight through and then goes out. And only birds have those kind of lungs. Birds are supposed to have evolved from creatures that have two-way lungs. So just ask yourself, could there ever have been a gradual development of one kind of lung to another? Remembering most animals die when they don't have oxygen within 2 minutes. We want thousands, or who is Carl Sagan, you know? Billions and billions of years, he tells us. These gradual developments. Well, I'd like to know how you can get from the one kind of lung to the other over long periods of time and not kill the organism. Well, I could go on and on and on giving you examples. The fact of the matter is, gradual changes will not be scientifically acceptable as an explanation for many life forms that we have. Well, then the alternative is, well, then it must be mutations, right? The difficulty there being that we know from a study of mutations that 99.9% of all mutations are harmful to an organism. Mutations usually kill an organism or make it unable to reproduce. The mutations do not pass from one generation to another. Those that do prove to be harmful to the organism. So now the theory of evolution is strapped with another difficulty. Either you have gradualism, which is asinine, really, for explaining bird lungs and human sexuality and the human eye and heart-lung mechanisms and so forth, or you have mutations, which prove to be harmful and usually not passed on to the other generation, to the future generation. Thirdly, as a scientific flaw, the theory of evolution cannot account for increasing complexity in a world that is said to be governed by chance. If chance, randomness, is the characteristic of nature, then why should there be increasing complexity? Now, this criticism can be narrowed or made more specific by those who argue that the second law of thermodynamics is violated by the theory of evolution. The second law of thermodynamics says that all things in the physical universe tend toward disorganization and coolness. That is a breaking down of complexity. The theory of evolution maintains, however, that things in the universe have developing complexity and heat, greater complexity. Well, how can that be given the second law of thermodynamics? The answer usually is, well, there must be an input of energy from outside the system. Studies, mathematical studies of thermodynamics have shown, however, that even if there were an input from sunlight and other things, there would not be enough energy generated in the system to account for the complexity of DNA molecules. Oh well. Do you think people are willing to give up the theory of evolution? Wait till you hear the fourth problem that I want to use as an illustration. Back in 1967, there was a conference in England whose papers were published as mathematical challenges to the neo-Darwinian interpretation of evolution, something like that. Mathematical challenges. People who study probability theory had looked at the factors that are involved in the evolutionary hypothesis and pointed out that in terms of mathematical models where randomness is taken seriously, that is, you can't have intervention, so you have to leave it totally random, that the mathematical probabilities of evolution are so slight that the period of time necessary for evolution to have taken place is like gargantuan proportions beyond anything what people think about the age of the universe. So here are the mathematicians who are saying, well, the problem is your theory won't work in the time frame in which you say the theory is supposed to work. And then fifthly, I've mentioned for you already the silliness of the punctuated equilibria rationalization for why the fossil record doesn't help us. If I had time, we could talk about biological clocks indicating there's not enough time for evolution to have taken place, and on and on and on. But all I want you to do, this is a philosophy class after all, I just want you to have some idea of the fact that there are numerous flaws, numerous scientific flaws with this theory. Fifthly, going back now, I've said I had six things to say by way of criticism. The first is it's not scientific, but philosophical. Secondly, it was refuted immediately and kept for its anti-religious, motivation. Thirdly, survival of the fittest is an ideological tautology. Fourthly, numerous scientific flaws. Now, fifthly, and many people, again, naive, are not aware of this, Darwin's theory has been abandoned today, and ousted, kicked out, forgotten. No one holds to Darwinian evolution. Let me repeat that. No one holds to Darwinian evolution. What is taught as evolution today is not Darwinism. Sometimes it's called neo-Darwinianism, but it's even beyond neo-Darwinianism now. The view of evolution that's now taught in the classroom is usually that certain mutations tend to leave more offspring. That's what the theory of evolution has been reduced to. Certain mutations tend to leave more offspring, or what's sometimes called differential reproduction. There are differences in the reproductive results between different kinds of species, and that's what's supposed to account for evolution. Why do I bother to tell you this? Not just to bring you up to date, but to indicate to you, obviously, the theory of evolution, therefore, is not held on to because of its scientific credentials. When people see that Darwin has totally been refuted, they don't give up the theory of evolution. They find a different version of it. What does that tell you? Well, it's not because they've gone out and looked at the world they believe this. This is a way they're going to look at the world. It is a perspective brought to the facts, not taken to it. And sixthly, from a philosophical standpoint, you need to understand that ultimately the theory of evolution is the view that things develop into their opposites. The view that things develop into their opposites. To put it very simply, what was not alive developed into what was living. And so non-life, given enough time and some kind of fancy gobbledygook by way of explanation, non-life becomes life. And unintelligent life becomes intelligent life. And here's the Samuel Alexander problem, emergent evolution. How can you account for man's reasoning ability, given the theory of evolution? One of the things that's involved, I mean, I could talk about many things, but I'm just going to illustrate briefly. One of the things that's involved in man's reasoning ability is abstraction. Men think in terms of general categories or universals, not just particular experiences. None of you, to take a previous illustration from my course, none of you have ever seen duckness. All right? Some of you have seen ducks, but none of you have ever seen duckness. So where do we get the concept, the abstract universal concept of duckness? Well, it's not built up from particular ducks, that's for sure. Because if it were, then what we would be building up in our experience is one particular sensation, another particular sensation. But where do we ever get a sensation of a universal called duckness? The theory of evolution cannot account for man's reasoning. Men reason in terms of logical patterns of inference. But no one has ever run into a logical pattern of inference in the world, to be very crude about it. No one's ever stubbed his toe on a law of logic. No one's ever said, you know, I accidentally put logic somewhere and I can't find it. It's not that kind of thing. I mean, it would be silly to talk that way. The theory of evolution cannot account for man's reasoning ability. Here you have non-abstract thinking that's based on sense particulars developing into reasoning regarding abstract concepts. How can that be? You have non-life developing into life, non-rationality developing into rationality, or abstract rationality anyway, and you have that which is without ethical determination evolving into that which has some concept of ethical obligation. The theory of evolution ultimately requires us to believe that things turn into their opposites. And if that doesn't dissuade you, then you obviously have some kind of worldview religious commitment. Because if you can affirm that A is not A or can develop into not A, to the very opposite of what it was, then I think you're willing to accept any absurdity intellectually. Well, let me close my thoughts on evolutionary naturalism by pointing out the influence of evolutionary naturalism. That doesn't mean I endorse this influence, but it's a fact we have to take into account. The methodological influence of evolutionary naturalism is the view that man must be understood historically and developmentally, so that throughout the various sciences, wherever man is thought of now as something that developed historically. That, I think, is the great intellectual and cultural influence of evolution on our methodology. Anything that's going to account for man's psychology or sociology or his ethics or his politics must be evolutionary in character. The philosophical influence of evolution is that man is part of nature. Man is an animal, just like all the others, simply more developed, more evolved. The theological impact of evolution was that in our culture it intensified the conflict between science and religion. Evolution turned out to be the leading specimen showing that religion and science can't get along. There's a conflict between them, and religious people are unscientific. Culturally, the influence of evolution has been the instilling in us the notion of optimistic progress. Everything is developing, and that means there's progress in history. Economically and politically, the influence of evolution has been, sadly, a view that there's a struggle for survival which leads to savage competition. So certain versions of capitalism today are really quite evolutionary when they're based upon the notion of savage competition as just part of the natural order of things. And others have tried to take control of the evolutionary development, seeing the savage competition that arises naturally, man must now intervene to civilize. And that means we need socialist plans for making men more civil toward one another, to take away their savage competition. And so you can see this theory has just been incredible in its influence, methodologically, philosophically, theologically, culturally, economically, and politically. It has been a very fertile presupposition or outlook. It's philosophically absurd, it's scientifically discredited, and yet it has really changed the spirit of our age. I think that's very sad, but do you want to ask any questions about evolutionary naturalism?
Yes? Could you repeat what you said, the influence on culture?
Yeah, the cultural influence of evolution has been the notion of optimistic progress. Optimistic progress. Everything's developing and developing for the good. On the other hand, economically and politically, people have said, well, the development that we see makes men savagely compete with each other, right? Survival of the fittest. And so, if we're going to really see that progress, man must now intervene in the process of nature and make us more civilized, which has been more or less the socialist approach. Yes?
Good. I can see a connection maybe to the messianic educational idea that since progress has to happen, education has to work, no matter what kind of education it is, because the idea that it's educated.
Yeah, the notion that education is going to help us runs hand in hand with many evolutionary outlooks. However, it is not part and parcel of evolution. But if you do have that education is the tool for civilizing man, then you would expect that education is going to naturally evolve and develop men into better creatures. That's right. Are any of you tempted to think that Darwin has something going for him? Anybody feel any apologetical challenge in Darwinism? I hope that I have, if nothing else, convinced you that this is not an intimidating theory. What's intimidating is the way in which people emotionally latch onto it and hold onto it and rationalize every bit of counter evidence you give them. That's intimidating. It's that so many people believe it, and then they sneer at us because we say, well, actually, I don't think that Darwin, really had anything philosophically or scientifically going for him. That's really a ridiculous theory. But it's become the religion of our age, or the spirit of our age, and that does depress me greatly. I suppose that only is the only competition for the depression that brings me is the theories of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And after we take a brief break, we'll then take a look at them. As we get underway now, the question that we should have is, where does Karl Marx fit into our little diagram here of 19th century thought? I think it'll be beneficial for us to take a moment and to reflect on that. It would be very easy to just add Marx to our line of secularism as one of the three major responses to Hume and Kant. After all, who else is on this line? Well, we have the utilitarians who were interested in social theory, right? They wanted to bring reform by way of a certain scientific analysis. We also have on the secularist line the materialist and positivist who said that it's matter that is real and we should govern our thinking by what is the positive empirical input of our experience. That's very much like Marx. We have Darwin, the evolutionary naturalist, on this line. And as a matter of fact, Karl Marx wanted to dedicate to Charles Darwin his book Das Kapital. And so he quite obviously liked what he saw in Darwin. And so it would make sense, wouldn't it, to put Marxism, on this line that I've called secularism or phenomenalism. On the other hand, Marx believed that he was offering a better Hegelian explanation for the development of history and man's social condition than, say, if you will, your mundane garden variety materialist was doing. And so Marx was certainly influenced by Hegelian thought because of his view of the way in which class struggle is like a thesis, antithesis, synthesis, although it's not clear whether he ever used that language per se in his writing. Nevertheless, he did think history was driven by inner negations within positions or forms of society. There's an inner negation that creates the opposition, and then for the sake of precision, history moves ahead to another level, and then another inner negation. So obviously he has a Hegelian, if you will, driving mechanism for history. And so I'm going to propose, if you wish, you can put Marx on the end of your line here on the chart, but I would propose that maybe we make one little line here that divides the difference between Hegelianism and secularism. And that's where I'm going to put Marxism. For the sake of completing the diagram that's on the board, secularism, we saw utilitarianism, and then materialism and positivism. And the last one on the line, evolutionary naturalism. Now, I've left this up here for you for a few days. I hope you do have it in your notes. If you don't find it helpful, well, then you don't have to keep it. But this seems to me, in like one glance, you get a nice summary of what the 19th century was. Responses to Hume's skepticism and Kant's metaphysical agnosticism, either rational or non-cognitive, secular, materialistic, with an interest in society, and then finally, an interest in social reform, which is secular and yet Hegelian, and that is Marxism. Don't forget that you have a chapter on Marx in your reading assignment, chapter 3 in Johnson's book, Intellectuals. How many of you have read that? So what do you think? Karl Marx, pretty noble guy, huh? I'll tell you, sometimes I realize it can sound only ad hominem, and in that sense would be fallacious, but for a man who wanted to teach how we could be more humane toward one another, and how we could manage financial matters, a man with that kind of anti-humane personality, who had apparently no ability to manage his own personal finances, you have to ask, was he in any position to tell the world how to bring economic reform? It's really incredible. Karl Marx was born in 1818. He died in 1883. Was born in the Rhineland to Jewish parents, well-to-do Jewish parents who had become Lutherans. He studied at the University of Berlin shortly after Hegel's death, was obviously influenced by Hegelianism. He eventually got his doctorate at the University of Jena, writing on the ancient materialist Epicurus and Democritus. While he was in university, he was renowned for living a bohemian lifestyle. In 1843, he went to Paris and there became affiliated with the radicals of the Parisian intellectual circle of that day, Heinrich Heine, Joseph Proudhon, and others. One of that circle described the Paris radicals, quote, as godless self-appointed gods. Godless self-appointed gods. These were heady, aggressive, proud individuals. In 1844, he began an association with Friedrich Engels, both of whom worked with a variety of revolutionary papers and workers' parties, and who together co-authored the Communist Manifesto in 1847. In 1848, Marx was tried for treason because he participated in the failed German Revolution, and although he was acquitted, technically, he was exiled. So we went back to Paris and then to Brussels and finally settled in 1849 in England. Throughout his life, he had financial troubles. That's putting it euphemistically. He had severe financial problems, built up debts that he could not pay, repeatedly appealed to family members, friends, associates to bail him out, and practically lived on the generosity of Friedrich Engels. When his mother finally got tired of his financial responsibility and would not share any further of the family inheritance with him, Marx turned against his mother, and it said that at the time of her death, he showed absolutely no remorse or interest. He moved while he was in exile in London at one point to the slum areas of London and there lived the remainder of his life, spending most of his days studying at the British Museum. In 1864, he became involved with the International Working Men's Association, often called in this literature the First International, the International Working Men's Association. There was a real struggle for leadership in the First International, and in 1876 it dissolved because of those internal conflicts, primarily because of Marx's conflicts with one Mikhail Bakunin, who was one of the most fascinating Russian intellectuals of the period. Bakunin was an outright anarchist. Anyway, their struggle led to the dissolving of the First International. Marx lived most of his life in obscurity, if we're to be honest. For over 20 years, he lived in the very same city with John Stuart Mill, who was one of the most knowledgeable men of the day, one of the most urbane, educated, exposed to every intellectual movement people of the day. Remember Mill? Who learned Greek at 3, had read Plato by 8, and so forth. And he was a massive intellect. I don't agree with him, but he had that stature. And through all of the volumes of Mill and his writings and his letters, you'll not find one reference to Karl Marx. And yet they lived in the very same city and were both writing on social theory and reform. And so I think we have to conclude that that Marx was basically an obscure, dirty, undisciplined, rejected man during his lifetime. Just a little bit of historical background on Friedrich Engels. Engels lived from 1820 to 1895. Engels was the son of a German industrialist who had business interests, the factory not only in Germany, but also in Manchester, England. And it was only because of his father's business acumen that Engels was able to work at all, hold down a job, and to make enough money to live and support Karl Marx. I take it as one of the leading indications of human foolishness in history that Engels spent his money on such an irresponsible person as Karl Marx, but he did. Engels is known, let me give you a little bibliography on him, for his book now called, it's not really the original title, but now called Anti-During, D-U-H-R-I-N-G, Anti-During, 1878. He authored the book Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific in 1883. In 1884, he published the book The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State, in which he saw the nuclear family, the kind of family we understand from a Christian standpoint to be biblical, mother and father and children, that nuclear family as being the cultural expression of the commitment to private property. In 1919, long after his death, his work Principles of Communism was published. So these four works you should be aware of. It was Engels, apparently, who used the expression dialectical materialism as a summary for the philosophy of Marx and Engels. Dialectical materialism. And remember I said when I traced Marx's history for you that it was in 1844 that he began to be associated closely with Engels, and they worked together through the rest of Marx's life. Some bibliography on Marx. The Communist Manifesto, I've already mentioned, 1848. I want to quote one sentence from the Communist Manifesto, just so you are able to boil it down. Quote, "The theory of the communist may be summed up in a single sentence." So you don't have to worry about whether Dr. Bonson got this one right. Marx and Engels put it right out for you. Quote, "The theory of the communist may be summed up in a single sentence, : abolition of private property." Abolition of private property. But I would warn you that you have to understand Marx's very unusual definition of property before you'll understand that sentence correctly. We'll get into that when I lecture on his views. The Communist Manifesto, 1848. Then in 1867, Marx published the first of three volumes entitled Das Kapital, or in English, Capital. Okay, so if the Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of private property, you need to understand what Marx's view of capital is so you know why he was against capitalism. Das Kapital, 1867. Marx never completed the last two volumes. Engels paid for him to write them for years and years, and after Marx's death, Engels found out to his chagrin Marx had been doing all kinds of other things and dabbling in things that Engels was not really all that happy about. Engels is the one who took his notes and finished Volume 2 and a good portion of Volume 3, I believe, and then another scholar finished Volume 3. Volume 2 was published in 1885, 2 years after the death of Marx, and Volume 3 in 1895. As I told you before, Marx wished to dedicate this to Charles Darwin. Darwin discreetly declined the honor. And if you wanted to know what a dense, convoluted, unreadable, if not downright ridiculous, theory Das Kapital was, it took over 4 years to sell only 1,000 copies of it. Over 4 years to sell 1,000 copies. Darwin sold out on the first day of publication. Quite a difference. You should also, well, Marx and Engels wrote a number of things I'm not mentioning, but the last thing I'll mention in the Marx bibliography is his Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts of 1844. His first major publication, where he held to the view that man externalizes himself in his work. Man, who man is externalized in his work. His work becomes property, and property as such separates one man from another. So man's work alienates him from his fellow man. And then it turns out that the property, which is the outcome of his work, becomes not valued but priced. That is, the value of a man's work becomes the price of a man's work, so he becomes alienated from himself as well. Which is an interesting psychological insight. I'm not sure you can build a philosophy on this. I'm not sure it's altogether accurate. But it's an interesting development. 1844, 4 years before the Communist Manifesto, Marx is maintaining that man is alienated from his fellow man through his work that creates property, and then he's alienated from himself because his property is not valued but priced. Trying to give you some opening hints about Marx's view. Remember the sentence from the Communist Manifesto. Remember this theory of alienation from the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts. Thirdly, remember that according to Karl Marx, and as I recall, this is the opening line of the manifesto, according to Marx, all history is the history of class struggles. All history is the history of class struggles, where socioeconomic factors are presupposed to be the key to historical development. Marx has a view of historical development, much like Hegel's, but according to Marx, it's socioeconomic factors that drive history. All history is the history of class struggle. And this leads in fourthly, again, this is just my introductory remarks about him. Fourthly, remember Engels' descriptive expression for Marxism, dialectical materialism. Marx said that it was necessary to stand Hegel on his head. To stand Hegel on his head. That's a very clever way to capture what he was talking about. He does believe history develops dialectically, but it's not absolute spirit that's working its way out in history, coming to greater self-consciousness. It's not idea that's working its way out, but rather matter that is working its way out dialectically in history. So, as he said, he had to stand Hegel on his head. Dialectical materialism rather than dialectical idealism. Okay, that's our first approximation to Karl Marx. Any questions before I take another look at him? I'd like to talk about Marx as a man and Marxism as a philosophy and give some overview and commentary on it. And then I'm going to turn to some detailed lecture material that tries to...
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com. where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.